This is the IBJ podcast for the week of June 29th, 2020, brought to you by the law firm Krieg DeVault. I'm Mason King. Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. As you know, the death of George Floyd on May 25th reinvigorated the public debate on police violence, but it also had the effect of elevating the larger conversation about systemic racism. One of the issues now back at the forefront of corporate America's consciousness is ensuring that employers treat diverse candidates fairly in the hiring process and provide equity in the workplace. This has been a longtime concern of our guests this week. Angela Freeman is a board member and soon-to-be past president of the not-for-profit group Women and High Tech. During Freeman's involvement, it has transformed from an organization primarily focused on advocating for women and generating network opportunities in the STEM field, that's of course science, technology, engineering, and math, to prioritizing diversity, equity, and inclusion. These are topics close to her heart. As a Black woman who grew up in a small town in Kentucky and forged a career for herself as a molecular biologist, eventually working for Eli Lilly and Company in Indianapolis. And while at Lilly, a Black female executive who served as a mentor inspired her to go into law. In 2009, when she was nearly 35, Freeman was accepted into Indiana University's McKinney School of Law. And today she is an intellectual property and patent attorney for Barnes & Thornburg, one of the largest law firms in the state. IBJ's Anthony Shutley has profiled Angela in the latest issue of IBJ, and we took the opportunity to ask her what companies need to be doing to hire more women and people of color while providing a workplace environment that allows them to thrive and advance. Here's our interview. Joining me in the IBJ podcast virtual studio is Angela Freeman. Angela, thanks so much for taking time to speak with us
today. Yeah, thank you for having me.
So you're an attorney, so I am going to hit you right off the bat with the devil's advocate question. You are a Black woman who has been very successful in two professions. You were a molecular biologist for Eli Lilly and Company for 12 years. You earned a law degree and became an intellectual property and patent attorney for Barnes & Thornburg, one of the biggest law firms in Indianapolis. What do you say to someone who wants to point to your success as evidence that there is no sexism or racism in STEM professions or in corporate America?
Well, yeah, so I will say I've had a absolutely beautiful and fulfilling and even upwardly mobile STEM and legal career. That's for sure. Here, all within the state of Indiana. But I must state that even within those fields, I think that I'm more the exception than the rule. With all the success that I have garnered, if you can consider that I've garnered success, I represent so many other women and people of color who don't share my same story or who also are successful, no question, but you don't hear all the challenges and obstacles and barriers that they had to overcome to get to those levels of success and fulfillment. And I think oftentimes those obstacles and barriers are ones that majority men and women simply don't face. We know we're going to face obstacles and barriers. And at least for my family, they kind of raised me that that's no excuse. You still be successful. You still overcome. And we're preparing you to be ready for whatever obstacles and barriers that you may face. So the fact that there are successful women and people of color certainly should not be the example that systemic racism and bias don't exist. Those are just people who have managed, typically through a great support system, through people who have supported them, invested them, mentored them, have been able to overcome those systemic obstacles and barriers that absolutely exist.
Where do we typically see the silos of discrimination, sexism and racism, in the STEM fields?
I don't know if I truly buy into the fact that there are silos. I really do believe that systemic racism is real, that it's kind of baked into all of our systems in this country. And I know people don't want to hear that and they don't like to hear that. And that's viewed as some kind of disparagement of the country. It's not. It's factual. It's just what it is. And I think the sooner that we as a country and a nation, and particularly leaders, accept that and move past it and say, okay, what can we do at this point to make things more fair and equitable? I think that that will get us beyond that. And racism is a strong word. I know people, you know, shudder at the thought. I don't know that all people are always necessarily racist, but I do believe there are some true biases. And many of them, while unconscious, we talk a lot about implicit bias or unconscious bias. But I think that gives a lot of credit to people who are absolutely exhibiting conscious bias. They know exactly what they think. They know exactly where those thoughts come from. And they are in a position of privilege or power to instill that, inflect that on people that, you know, they report to them or they supervise. And that is different than someone who truly is unaware and doesn't appreciate that some of their views may be stoked in bias that they don't appreciate or are knowledgeable of. So my point is, you know, when we talk about racism, I think that is along the gamut of conscious bias. When someone is consciously biased, they know you're qualified. They know you can do the job. They know that you are credible. But because you come in a particular package, you're a particular gender, you're a particular race or ethnicity, you're LGBTQ, whatever the bias is, in their mind, you're just not qualified. That's racism. That's prejudice. That is absolutely built into most companies, systems, institutions in this country. And then the silos, I think, are those that are areas or industries where there has just been historically fewer people of color or women to really penetrate those industries, science, technology, engineering, and math, and then the legal field, unquestionably, are industries that have just historically not been open to women and people of color. And so the longer that they've women and people of color kind of been shut out, the more those industries have been able to perpetuate bias and prejudice and racism in whatever forms that have been acceptable for them to be present. So certainly, you know, 20 and 30 years ago, law firms were less diverse than they are today. I'm an example, truly, of being, particularly not just being in a big law firm, but being in intellectual property, which is a very specialized and niche area of the legal field. And I recognize that I sit in spaces and places where there are not a lot of people who look like me. But I think the more that women and people of color are put in a position to show that they can be valuable and be experts in those fields, it begins to open up doors for more diversity.
Let's say that I'm a hiring manager for a STEM company. Give me some directives for helping me diversify my workforce, for finding and hiring more women and people of color.
There are a few things here, particularly at the hiring phase, because at hiring, I mean, there are certain things that any company in Indiana or anywhere should do to attract women and people of color. I mean, for me, when I was in law school looking for law firms that I would be interested in working for, I remember telling some of my peers and colleagues, look, if they don't have a diversity statement, if they don't have a diversity committee, that right there is a big red flag that they're probably not going to be attuned to what your needs are, or your needs certainly have not bubbled up to where they have taken priority in that company. So some of those things are just big fat red flags for me. I appreciate that there may be smaller or mid-sized companies that don't have a dedicated diversity officer, but I think that's a big deal. Like if you're of a certain size of company, you absolutely should have a dedicated diversity officer. And I would also say that the only person on your executive team should not be that person, your diversity officer. I think over the last 10 years, it's been pretty acceptable that if you have an executive team and you have one woman and one person of color, whether male or female, as the diversity officer with all white males, you know, that's considered diverse. I think now that's probably not going to be able to cut it anymore. If the only executive person is the diversity officer, rather than a more substantive role, the chief financial officer, the chief information officer, the chief science officer. I think that speaks to more tokenism. It looks more like, okay, we've got our one, check that box, we're good. And I don't know, after the current climate, the unrest, Black Lives Matter, George Floyd, if that's really going to be able to cut the mustard anymore going forward.
Okay.
With regard to hiring practices, I think there are a lot of things that can be done and should be done in order to give women and people of color a fair chance. I would first say, I think there needs to be more hiring committees versus a single hiring manager. If you talk to people of color in corporate America, there are too many stories where one single person made the decision that you, as a woman or person of color, was not good enough for that role, that company, that organization. And that just really shouldn't be allowed anymore. There should be committees of folks that make the hiring decisions. And on those committees, there should be diverse people, diversity of thought, diversity of background, diversity of experiences, where there can be conversations and robust and honest conversations about what metrics and characteristics you're really looking for when you hire for a position. Because what I've seen is that too often women and people of color get dinged or disqualified for a role based on really insignificant things that, if it was a majority woman or man, wouldn't even be a talking point. But because it's a person of color or a woman or some type of diverse person, it becomes a disqualifying characteristic. And I just think that's unfair. And if there is a real committee that is open to having conversations, you can challenge some of those. Well, Jane, why is this guy's 3.8 GPA so bad when we just talked about John and he had a 3.83 and it was perfectly fine, right? Like, I mean, some of those real things that happen in hiring and selection committee. I also think that with regard to hiring, I think people and women of color oftentimes get no credit. There's no value seen in having grit and grind and hard work and overcoming barriers. Hiring committees are looking at the metrics, GPA, experience, and not considering that, well, this person may or may not have the same opportunities to have a summer job or a summer associateship. Or maybe this person was taking care of a child and was going to school at the same time or working a part-time job. What I've learned is that most leaders have a story. Most leaders have overcome some things, have gone through some obstacles and some barriers and some challenges that would speak to their character as a leader that really doesn't necessarily show up on any hiring manifesto to check a box. But in my world and in my experience, makes all the difference between who would be an exceptional leader and who would not.
Let's take a quick break to hear from our sponsor. This is the IBJ Podcast.
The IBJ Podcast is brought to you by Creek DeVault, a trusted and dynamic law firm representing a wide variety of local, regional, and national clients. Committed to each other and to every client, Creek DeVault prides itself on integrity, professionalism, respect, and excellence. Financial institutions, global manufacturers, national healthcare providers, and successful organizations of all sizes and market focus rely on Creek DeVault to create innovative and successful business solutions. Connect today at www.creekdevault.com.
Okay, we're back with the IBJ Podcast. Our guest this week is Angela Freeman, and we're talking about how companies can become better at hiring diverse candidates and then provide equity in the workplace.
How do you discover those more kind of qualitative qualities in an interview process? I'm racking my brain to think of, how could I ask the question, how do you have grit?
Yeah.
Without being afraid to.
give us an example of what obstacles you've overcome in your career path. Give us an example of what barriers you have worked through to get to this level. Give us an example of where you've experienced lack of opportunity and use that to your advantage to, you know, be successful. I mean, that's the question you ask. And that begins to speak to grit and grind in a way that may not show up on, you know, any hiring sheet, but really begins to allow you to see who this person is and more importantly, who they are when they're under stress.
Now, once I've been hired and I'm a woman or a person of color, what forms do discrimination take? I assume that, you know, people aren't going to walk up to me and say, well, you're a woman, I don't think you can do this. Or, you know, I don't like you because you're Black or Latino. How does that manifest itself in more sort of pernicious ways in the workplace?
So before we get to once you're hired, I want to give one more example of how this manifests itself in the hiring process.
Sure.
Because women and people of color hear this all the time. When you're being hired, you're being interviewed, or they're discussing you after your interview, it's clear that you're qualified, you have all the credentials, you got the GPA, you've got the experience. The question and conversation often goes to, well, we're just a little concerned about how they're going to fit.
Yeah.
Fit. That is how discrimination raises its head in the workplace and in hiring. You're absolutely qualified. You've got the background, you've got the credentials. So it's not about whether you're qualified. It's really the conversation, although it's not going to be explicit. Are we really comfortable with having this Black woman in our, you know, on our team? That's not going to be the question. The question is going to be, well, how do we think she's going to fit? And what that is actually code for is, are we going to be comfortable having this diverse woman on our team? And how is that going to make us feel on a regular basis or daily basis? And I can tell you, I've lost jobs because I just didn't fit. And what I've learned is that's probably the biggest blessing I could have ever been, because if I don't fit, then I don't fit. And that's fine. But I think that is how discrimination raises its head without being just clearly discriminatory, because nobody's saying, oh, she's Black, or oh, she's a woman, or oh, she may be this or she may be that. But it's covered in or camouflaged as we're concerned about fit.
So, I mean, I can see where, you know, the hiring people, the people who have interviewed that candidate, you know, are essentially asking themselves, you know, does this person have the same background and the same kind of interests that I do?
Yeah.
Because we feel like, you know, that's important for us to have a good vibe at work. Tell those guys why that is overrated. Why is it important to have somebody who is not necessarily like you?
Well, I can tell you, as the only African-American female attorney in the IP department in Barnes and Thornburg, and I say the only in Indianapolis, because I have a colleague in Dallas, I think that I have added to the culture of our team. In other words, if you spoke to my majority white Caucasian male colleagues, that having Angela on the team actually adds something to the team. A little flair, a little fun, a little excitement. I mean, we have a great time. And it is a great time in enjoying our differences and then reveling in our similarities. I think what you have opened yourself up for when you allow people who are different than you on your team and allow an opportunity for you to actually get to know people that you otherwise may not have gotten to know, is what you typically learn is, while I thought we were so different, and we are different, we're different ethnicities, we come from different parts of the world, different countries, different cities, different states, more often than not, what you learn is how much more similar you are than different. And you have to be open to that experience. You have to be open. If you're just stoked in, she's a Black female from Kentucky, she's, you know, she's 45 and I'm 53, she went to a little country school and I went to a private school. if that's all you allow yourself to see, then that's all it'll be. But if you actually give me an opportunity to speak with you, what you'll probably learn is we actually end up having, even with those differences understood, we probably end up having more similarities than differences. What I've learned and why I appreciate diversity is because I learn from so many different people all the time about things that I just would never know about. But most importantly, what I learned is, even with all those differences, we're actually more similar than we are different. And I think that is the common human thread that people who have biases, have races, have prejudice, are just so scared of. They're scared to know how similar to this Black female you really are than you would like to think otherwise.
Okay, so let's go back now to the ones I've been hired.
Yeah.
And I'm a woman or person of color. How is that discrimination manifesting itself?
Yeah, so most often the way that manifests itself is you are a part of the team. So, you know, if we're going to a business meeting, you go. If we have a conference call, you're on there. But when those teammates begin to enjoy their social time, you're not part of that team. So when work is over and the team goes to, you know, the barbecue or goes to the juke joint and has a beer or whatever, you know, they do, goes golfing on Saturday, you don't get the invitation to those networking opportunities. And I think most people in corporate understand that that's really where the magic happens, right? If you're entertaining a client or you're trying to make a business deal or you're trying to get hired somewhere, the formal interview, the formal meeting is the meeting. But really, oftentimes where the decisions are made is after the meeting, at dinner or drinks or coffee or golf or whatever it is, where the person is really deciding, do I really like this person enough to be around them all the time? And will I trust them with my business? And those are often the places where women and people of color don't get invited. They don't get those opportunities, such that when you sit in the meeting and you're all ready and you've done your homework and you're coming prepared, you don't know that Sam and Mike just had played golf on Friday. And they've already made the decision that's actually going to get discussed in Monday's meeting. And everybody's under the guise that this decision's getting made on Monday, when in fact the decision got made on Friday over golf.
What about situations where a woman or a person of color might be passed over for a promotion or just not get, you know, the level of responsibility that a more sort of majority?
Absolutely. So that happens all the time. So again, not explicit, not overt, oftentimes not even known, but those things happen all the time. And that's probably the biggest detriment, because you can be successful if you're not buddy-buddy with everybody. Nobody says that everybody you work with, you just got to be buddy-buddy with and friends, and you know, you go over their house and they come over your house. But the bigger detriment is when Tom and John have a relationship that allows Tom, the supervisor, to always give John the premier opportunities, whether that you get to write the paper or you get to present in front of the management committee or you get to go to the client meeting that I may not get, and quite frankly, am never even aware of, because Tom and John have kept it between themselves, such that, you know, all the rest of the team, including me as the woman or person of color, never even know such opportunities exist. Those small opportunities lend to larger opportunities, right? And if you get left in the fray from the beginning, such that you never have the opportunity to meet the client or go on the business trip or present the presentation to, you know, the decision makers and stakeholders, then you get left in the fray, because opportunity builds on opportunity. You get left behind. You look up and you and John started at the same time, same level. 3 years later, John is partner and you're still, you know, junior associate, and you're wondering, how did this happen?
So let's say I'm the HR manager or I'm a department head give me five or however many, three, four, five directives for helping women and people of color thrive in advance in the company.
One of the things you can absolutely do is make sure that women and people of color are set up outright with a mentor. In other words, when you bring them in, you've decided to hire them, you're going to bring them in, you bring them in for training, from the very start, you should assign them to a mentor. Someone who has committed that, I'm going to make sure this young lady or this person of color is successful. That's necessary because, number one, when you're coming to a new organization or a new entity, you don't know. There are just some unwritten rules that you can't know unless somebody tells you. And when you first start off, you need to have at least a point person to go ask those kind of questions. Another thing I would suggest is make sure that when you bring in women and people of color into your corporate environment, that your corporate culture and environment is truly open to them. Because if not, it becomes very clear very quickly to a woman, a person of color, if they were just hired to check a box, to meet a quota, to say, okay, yes, we have diversity. But once they get there, it's closed doors, closed mouths. Nobody has anything to say to you. Nobody invites you to the team picnic. Nobody has a welcoming comment. And you begin to hear the rumbles of, yeah, she's here, but can she really do the job? Can she? You know what I'm saying? And that speaks to your corporate culture. That becomes clear very quickly. So while you may be successful in hiring someone, the reality is going to become very clear pretty quickly once that person is inside your corporation and really begins to see what the culture is like. And if the culture is not conducive to them being successful, if they've got to fight for everything, if they've got to fight for opportunities, if they've got to fight to speak in a meeting without being interrupted or disrespected, that's not going to last long. They will be spending more time focusing on looking for their next opportunity than doing your task at hand, because they've already realized that this is not going to work for me long term.
You know, a lot of companies, very well-meaning, start diversity initiatives for hiring more women and people of color. You know, I don't think they very often have much to show for it.
That's
where
right.
Does that run aground usually?
Yeah, so part of that goes to the concept over the last decade to two decades of diversity, meaning women and typically white women. If you look at diversity statistics, if you look at diversity metrics, the only people who really gained from diversity initiatives over the last decade or two have been white women. And that's because white women have been considered diverse because, particularly in STEM and legal fields, they're predominated by white men. But for people of color and women of color in particular, white women don't really, I mean, it's kind of offensive to me for a white woman to be considered diverse. Typically, white women have all the benefits of their male counterparts, you know, so, and the statistics make that clear, that white women have been the biggest beneficiary of all the diversity metrics, all the diversity initiatives. So I think you have to be strategic and intentional about hiring women of color or diverse women when you state that that's who you want to hire. I think you have to be intentional in your recruitment. I think you have to be intentional on your hiring. I think you have to be intentional on the people you put on the hiring committee. Because I've even seen, just with my board work and with I'm on the diversity committee at Barnes & Thornburg. I'm on the hiring committee. And I have seen how even the most well-intended people who say, yes, we're open to diversity and we're going to hire diverse candidates, when it gets down to two candidates, still the non-diverse candidate will typically raise higher, even when we've said, hey, our intent is to make sure we're hiring diverse people. And I think that's because that's just innately the position of majority people. It's just their comfort zone to hire people who look like them, talk like them, come from the same place as them. And when you have a diverse person and a non-diverse person who are pretty equally qualified. Unless you make it absolute, we're hiring the diverse talent, that non-diverse person will typically win out. And the committee leaves saying, we did a good job today. We didn't hire a diverse person, but we interviewed a lot of diverse people, and that counts. That does not count. It doesn't count. If you hire a non-diverse person over a qualified diverse person with the intent to diversify your company, you fail. Another thing I really want to make clear is, when I'm talking about diverse talent, I'm talking about qualified diverse talent. In other words, a lot of people think that when you're hiring diverse talent, quote unquote, you're somehow lowering the bar. Like, we've already just inherently lowered our requirements, lowered our criteria. And I will tell you, as a person of color and a woman of color, that's offensive. I am the most strict, like stringent person on quality. Like, excellence is the biggest factor. For sure. Quality, qualified. You have to be an expert in your field. And I am the hardest on my people of color. Like, I've had more challenging conversations with my own people to say, look, let me tell you why you're not going to get this position. Or let me tell you why we're not going to be able to hire you. And those are hard conversations. But on the flip side, when you find qualified, diverse talent, they ought to get a real tough look and serious consideration. And I've just been in too many rooms where the person of color has the higher degree, they have more experience, they are unquestionably the most qualified candidate. But somehow the conversation can sway people to be convinced that the non-diverse, not as credentialed, not as educated person, still has equal credentials to the diverse person who does. And there has to be a voice in that room that says, hold on, in my mind, this person is absolutely more qualified and she's diverse. That should, and she's a woman, that should give her two extra pluses in the box, not, you know, a minus in the box.
What do you say to employers who say, man, we looked. We talked to all the colleges. We talked to all the professional organizations.
Yep.
We tried to find somebody, that would come and talk to us, and we just couldn't find anybody.
Yeah.
What are they not doing that they should be doing?
Probably 2 years ago, I would have said that's BS. Like, I don't even believe it. But, you know, again, being in a position where I too have been on selection committees and recruiting committees and hiring committees, I also have a better appreciation of the reality that it's not always easy to find and recruit and hire diverse talent. I have had to check myself because I have done as much as go on Spanish-speaking media stations with translators and get on media stations that are targeted to people of color to recruit people and still not have qualified diverse candidates in the pool. So I know what that feels like and what it looks like. And I can no longer say that that's just BS because I've done it myself. But I would also encourage you or that person to look, particularly in professional organizations. I know you mentioned those, but for every professional organization, there is a professional organization that is an affinity group. So the National Black MBA Association, the National Society of Black Engineers, the National Organization of Black Chemists and Chemical Engineers, that is an affinity group made for diverse people, but also have those credentials and professional qualifications that an employer may be looking for. Going to Black sororities and fraternities on campuses who are graduating, people of color or women who have these particular skills. The Urban League, who are targeting people of color, whether it's the Hispanic Association, the, Black Association, whatever it may be, that have the skill set you're looking for, but also have diverse talent. And then just word of mouth. I mean, if you know of people of color or women who are engaged in the community, get the word out. I mean, people know people, and you may not know them, but, you know, we've learned that there's only, you know, it used to be, what, 6 degrees of separation. I think we've learned in the last few years it's only like 2 or 3.
Yeah,
like, you're usually not too far away from somebody who knows somebody who either is your target candidate or knows where you can find that target candidate. It does take more work. I will absolutely agree to that. It takes more work. It's not something you can think of last minute and be like, oh, well, we sent 2 emails and we didn't get anybody, so, you know, we've done our due diligence. It typically does take a little more effort and a little more due diligence. But even in Indianapolis, you can find diverse talent if you're really looking for them and want to hire them.
Well, this has been super enlightening. And I know, you know, at the IBJ, we're going to have a lot of conversations like this in the future, too. So it's a great help.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it, and appreciate having the conversation for sure.
My thanks again to Angela Freeman. Her journey from Berea, Kentucky, to the labs of Eli Lilly and Company, and then to the halls of Barnes & Thornburg, has really been fascinating. And you can read more about it in the profile written by reporter Anthony Shutley in the latest edition of IBJ. And there are a couple other stories I want to bring to your attention. Lindsay Erdody examines the puzzling lack of momentum for the Democratic gubernatorial candidate, Dr. Woody Myers. His resume seems tailor-made for this moment, with a medical degree and solid experience in public health. And although he's the first Black candidate for governor for either of the major political parties, Myers and the governor's race aren't top of mind right now for the Black community. Also in this week's issue, Sam Quinn explores claims that a tidal wave of home evictions is coming this summer, with more than 250,000 Hoosier families needing help paying their rents. Now you can read all these stories in this week's print edition of IBJ or online at IBJ.com. And remember, for full and unfettered access to all of IBJ's award-winning business content, just click the subscribe button. Thanks again for making time this week for the IBJ podcast, which is edited by Leslie Weidenbetter. I'm Mason King. Hang in there, folks. We'll be back again next week.